That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Extra long bonus sort of episode today because, as my boy Scoop Jackson said in the Spanish Inquisition, he wished he talked a little less. But when you get two of us together that both feel that way about ourselves, you're bound to get a slightly longer than average podcast. But really good stuff from Scoop, who is currently a senior writer for SportsCenter, writer for The Undefeated, and has had many different titles at ESPN and a ton of work outside of ESPN for Slam, XXL, Nike, Rock and Jock, all sorts of interesting stuff that we get into. So it's a great conversation. Settle in and enjoy it. Here it is.
That's what she said.
Happy now to welcome in my friend and colleague, Scoop Jackson, senior writer for SportsCenter, has been a writer and editor for countless outlets, Slam, XXL, Hoop, USA Today, Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, The Source, Vibe, ESPN, The Mag, tons of stuff, and a Chicago guy who I've known for, man, since I moved back to Chicago in 2008. We ran into each other kind of early on when I moved back.
Real early on. You were still under the radar. You know,
I was.
You were in conversation with the suit.
That's right.
Before you even came over to ESPN, you were in conversation. So they had their eye on you, and you know, I went back to the suits and told them they need to keep their eye on you. They said, you're already too late. We already got an eye on it. So
I appreciate that.
Right. This is before, you know, you became the Sarah Spain. So yeah.
That's right. I do actually require people to call me the Sarah Spain now when I meet them for the first time.
It's like you reach that status. Yeah. You're supposed to.
Yeah.
Like, Stephen A. Smith can't have all the light, so you got to take
right.
over here.
That's right. All right, well, we're going to get into that senior writer for SportsCenter gig and some of your other gigs, but I like to start at the beginning. And if Wikipedia is right, which it is at least a small percentage of the time, your name Scoop Jackson came from a very funny place. So tell me about that.
Yeah, I happen to be born. First off, I need to update my Wikipedia thing. I had never looked at my Wikipedia page until maybe a couple of months ago when I was doing a project for somebody else. And they needed some background information on me, and they pulled up my Wikipedia page and, you know, were giving me information about that. I was like, ooh, I need to maybe update that. That's kind of
right,
like,
right.
Yeah, I need to get that closer to being accurate. But the story behind the day I was born is I happened to be born the day after JFK was assassinated. And at the time, my father was the only black newspaper reporter in Chicago. And my mother's brother, my uncle, Cliff, made a joke at the hospital while I was being born. And he said, Bob, news are you having a child that's going to scoop Kennedy, you know, with the whole news terminology.
Yeah.
So right then and there, that's how I got the name Scoop. They gave me the name on the premise, and it's kind of ridden with me. You know, it's official. It's not, you know, it's for real.
You know, in
quotations,
your birth certificate?
All that stuff. It's for real, yeah.
Now, did they care at all about was the Scoop Jackson the politician around then?
Henry Scoop, I think he was around. But, you know, he was in New York. I don't know how well known he was in these parts. You know, I think, you know, just the newspaper term of being Scoop and my father being, you know, a professional journalist at the time. I don't know if they put the Jackson together. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I don't know if they did. But he seemed to be, from my research on him, and people in New York who were around the time that, you know, were there under his, you know, tenureship in politics there, they said he was a nice, progressive, nice guy. So it wasn't like, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't like they named me after Donald Trump or anything like that.
Right, exactly. So when you were growing up, you know, your dad was in journalism. What did your mom do? Did she work?
You know, my mom was a social worker. She worked for the Department of Children and Family Services.
Okay, great. So you grow up with two obviously socially invested and progressive people. What did you want to be when you were just a kid?
You know, like everybody else, I wanted to be a lot of things. I was kind of all over the place. I was one of those kids that grew up having a clear understanding that I was not supposed to be here because my mother had like 7 miscarriages before she had me. Yeah, and you know, so it was, I've always, you know, I was raised under, like, hey, you're not supposed to be here, so you have to do something special. You know, there's a reason you're here, all this, that, and the other. So with that being said, as a child, you know, there was a lot of things I wanted to do. I had a lot of interest. You know, I could draw very well, so I wanted, you know, I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be a veterinarian because I love animals. You know, I wanted to play basketball because that's what Julius Erving did. You know, I love music, so I wanted to be a DJ, you know, because they weren't doing anything, you know, musically in Chicago. You know, and I was hanging around, you know, my uncles and all them listening to jazz. And, you know, I didn't hear jazz. I'm like, you know, somebody needs to be playing some, you know, Coltrane and some, you know, and some Thelonious Monk up in here. Why am I listening to, you know,
right,
as silly as I sound? Why am I keep listening to Michael Jackson? I want to hear something different. You know? So I was all over the place. And it was funny because in high school, my best friend and I said we're going to have our own magazine. Because he was an artist, and we were both artists. We drew a lot, but I was deep into magazines as a kid, and I wanted to basically get in the magazine game. But I wanted, like I said, get in the music game also. But me and my friend Brad always said we wanted to have our own magazine. And I wanted to somehow do a black version of The Village Voice.
Huh. Cool.
And as I got older, that kind of stayed there, and, you know, magazines became more sectionalized. In that, you know, I mean, specified in what they were targeting. The difference between magazines and newspapers were basically newspaper covered everything. Magazines covered specific areas. And I wanted to find something that covered specific areas. So, you know, in the black community, we had an Ebony and Jets, and then we had our Essence magazines, and we had a few other magazines that catered to, you know, our you know, the black experience in America. And at some point, I wanted to have a voice in that. You know, so that's kind of where it kind of, you know, that, so around college, that's where it kind of, you know, narrowed in, you know.
Yeah.
Now, not to be long-winded, but sir, keep in mind, I was the guy in college that got a license to cut hair.
Uh-huh.
I got a license to drive a cab, and I got a license to bartend. My whole thing was about hustle.
Yeah.
So, you know, I knew what I was studying, so I studied political science, you know, because I wanted to get into politics, being from Chicago. But at some point, I had my hustle game on. I knew I was going to do something.
Yeah.
And for me, I started working at 14 years old. I lied on my uncle was telling me I'm going to suffer for this when it comes to retirement. I lied because I could start working at McDonald's on 1798 at 14 years old. So I lied on my application so I could start working on it because we needed the money. My father and my mother split up when I was in second grade, you know, and to sit around and watch my mom, you know, even though she had a decent job, a decent position, it feels like, you know, you know, it's just your mom, and she's bringing in the income. And I'm like, I can't sit around and, like, play basketball all day. I got to do something. So I started working at 14 years old, and I've literally been working every day since I've been 14 years old. But
yeah.
I didn't know what I was going to do. So I knew I had to have some money. So if I was going to drive a cab, I was going to do that.
You got some,
you know,
skills.
If I was going to be a DJ, I was going to do that. You know, if I was going to, like, be a veterinarian, you know, whatever it was. Whatever it was, I was going to cut hair. If I was going to bartend, I was going to do something. So that was my security. But in college, it kind of narrowed down. And
now,
I really started to fall into the writing piece. And, you know, it kind of took form from there.
Did your parents ever have any other kids, or were you the only child?
I have a younger brother.
Okay.
He's 2 years younger than me. Jack is 2 years younger than me. Yep.
It could either be inspiring to you to feel as if you weren't meant to be here and that there was a purpose, or it could be overwhelming. Actually, just randomly, like a week ago, I was talking to a bartender who had question mark tattoos on his neck. And I asked what it was about, and he said he got in a terrible car crash in high school, and all of his friends passed away except for him. And he spent decades trying to figure out why me, and it crippled him in a way that he just recently has been able to escape from and try to, you know, make good on. And so I wonder if there was a part of you at first that felt the pressure of that instead of the inspiration of it.
Okay, two things. That's very interesting you say that. One is not the pressure, because I think when my father and my mother separated, my grandmother told me, all right, you're the man of the house. And I think I was in fourth grade. I was in second grade, actually, when they split up. When he moved to Colorado, I was in fourth grade. So she's like, all right, you know, now you're the man of the house. But the one thing that happened with that, and especially with, you know, my mother not going after him for child support, my mother was one of those very strong, militant, you know, women that you know, like, I got this, you know,
right. Literally.
Like, she literally was like, look, y'all mess up, I can replace you. You all will be shot quick by me. Not by anybody in the streets, by me. Keep messing around. That's the type of house she ran. But she ran the whole neighborhood like that. You know, but I say that to say is that there was always a sense of responsibility that I had at a very early age. So it didn't, like, overtake me with, you know, with, oh, my God, this is too much. No, because, you know, that my grandmother told me I was a man of the house, it was really that. Like, my mom would be at work, we'd start cooking dinner. We had to do our own laundry. All this started, like, when I was in fourth grade. I started working at 14 years old. So I've always had some type of sense of responsibility. And I tell kids, like, when I would speak to kids in high school and sometimes in grammar school, but especially in college, you know, I tell them, my father wasn't around. And he's still my dad, you know what I'm saying? But he wasn't in the house. He wasn't financially. He wasn't there day to day. He was living in a whole other space. So I grew up technically in a single family home since second grade. But it's the best thing that happened to me. It's the best thing because it taught me how to be responsible. It taught me how to take this 24 hours a day and the 8 hours I'm not sleeping and the 8 hours I'm not in school and not BS those, you know, other 8 hours because you got stuff to do.
Right.
And I came up under that. So, you know, when you hear all these stories about black kids, you know, and young men not having their fathers around and that being a crutch or an excuse, I'm like, that's BS. You all got to man up and come out of that. I'm a living example of that. You know, it's a matter of how you internalize things and what you put on you that you know you can take. And I've always been the type of person that I don't mind pushing myself. I like to see what limits I can go to. You know, and even as a kid, I did that. Now, what made it interesting, what you said, is that in 1987, I, too, was in a very bad car accident that I was supposed to die in. The only thing that saved my life in that car accident is that I wasn't wearing my seatbelt. Strange as it sounds, I was on Lakeshore Drive coming home. My brother had disappeared, and I was running all over the city trying to find him. And, literally, it was like 3 in the morning. And it's one of those 90-degree days in Chicago. And I was listening to the OJs when I should have been listening to, like, Parliament Funkadelic. At 3 in the morning, you're tired. You can't listen to some smooth music.
Yep.
So I nodded off right by the Museum of Science and Industry and ran straight into a light pole.
Wow.
And, like, I was, like, the only thing that saved me was, like, say, I didn't have a seatbelt on. They said because I was asleep and my body was limp, if I had the seatbelt on, you know how your seatbelts lock?
Yeah.
My neck would have broken by the impact because my body there wouldn't have been any resistance. My body was sleep, so my neck would have broken instantly. I would have died.
Wow.
But I had to go through physical therapy. I had the exact same accident that Kanye had.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, exact same. Wires were jarred for months. I had to learn how to eat again. I had to go through physical therapy, learn how to walk, everything. Damn near the same thing happened to Kanye.
Yeah.
I went through it. But here's the funny thing also. It goes back to what my grandmother was telling me and what my mother said. And I always say it is that, and my grandmother told me this while I was in the hospital. You're here for a reason. There's a reason you survived that accident. You know what I'm saying? So here it is. I heard this as a kid because I wasn't supposed to be born because of my mother's miscarriage. Then, you know, when I'm however 20, whatever, I forgot. I was working for the city at the time. But it was in 1987. So I'm like maybe 23 years old. You know, and I had this accident that I'm supposed to be dead, that people don't even live from. You know, and all right. That reinforces, all right, yeah, you have to be here. You know, there's a reason you're here. So, you know, not that I was BSing my life away, but I needed to, like, really internalize and do what your friend did. You know, like, all right, let me make this worthwhile. You know, because this is the second time in my life that I wasn't supposed to be here. And I need to try to do whatever I can to do something special. You know, and not just marginal, but find out exactly why I'm here. And it didn't take me long at all. And, you know, the minute I was able to get some Harold's Chicken back in my system, I was like, the minute I was able to chew again, I was good.
That's right. So when you got to, was it Xavier where you were dabbling in all sorts of jobs to kind of keep the money coming
in? Well, that was in Xavier. That was undergrad. And the accident happened after I graduated.
Okay. And you were a political science major at Xavier.
I was a poli sci major, had to leave school my sophomore year because we didn't have any money. And I dropped out, came back to Chicago, worked 3 jobs here in Chicago. I worked for the city, handling payroll for the city, because that was my summer job. I did payroll for the city during the summer. But when I left school, they gave me a job, you know, to carry me over. I worked for my uncle, and I also worked for I worked at a restaurant in Watertower called Eternity. It was a food restaurant that the Levy organization owned before they became Levy organization. Like, before they blew up.
Yeah.
Like you blew up. Like, Levy only had, like, maybe 2 or 3 restaurants, and they were all in the water tower.
Yeah.
So I worked at one of those. So I had 3 jobs working while I was out of school, got the money right, paid the school off, went back to school, changed my major to mass communications. because I just, you know, I've always been interested in, you know, the mass media. And I wound up just graduating with a double major in political science and mass communication.
And then did you go straight to Howard, or was there a gap between?
Nope. The city, because I was working for the city all the time, they offered me a nice, like, for real job. Like, all right, you know, working for the city of Chicago, I had been working there for like 5 summers. And then, you know, that year in between. So when I came out, they had a job for me.
Nice.
So I started working for the Department of Children. Not that was getting my mother's job. I was working for Department of the Mayor's Office of Employment and Training, MET, and then I went over to Department of Sewers, and I was just handling payroll. I've been doing payroll. I have a deep payroll background.
Now, at any point, did you think that would just be your career? Like, I've already got a job. I'm already set up. I'm just going to ride this.
Well, here's the thing. I was always hustling, trying to do something inside of media, you know, doing something and trying to get a job at one of the local newspapers, at the radio station, you know, and kept getting turned down and, you know, not getting jobs and all that and the other. But, you know, as long as I was making income, I was cool, you know, but I wasn't going to sit on that for long. But what happened was a car accident, you know, escalated my process. That's when I was like, because the minute I came out of the hospital, I kind of feel bad about this because, you know, the insurance you have when you have a job takes care of those bills. And like I said, the minute I was able to chew, I gave my resignation at the city. I'm like, I'm out. I applied to grad school at Howard University in Northwestern. That was it. And I knew I wanted to go to Howard for undergrad, but my mother wouldn't let me go because that's where she went. And she's like, I'll be damned if they get another penny of my money, but I'm paying for this time. So I have a little bit of control over it. So I applied to Howard, and in case Howard didn't go through, I was going to go to Northwestern. And but that was my plan. I was like, I got to do something. And that came from that accident. You know, laying in the hospital bed, like, I'm not supposed to be here. Let me start doing something. So I'm like, you know what? You know, let me go to grad school. You know, working for the city is fine. I'm doing stuff, and it's cool, but this can't be my life's calling.
Right.
You know, I got to do something. So that's when the journey really started to take a different turn. It was
so
right then
Howard,
after the accident. Huh?
When you got to Howard, did you know?
When I got to Howard, yep. I had the accident in 87, started at Howard in 1989. Because I had to get my money up now. I understand that. That's why I had to work for the city. I gave my resignation, but I had to work to get my money together to pay for Howard. So.
But when you got to Howard, journalism was the goal.
No, not at all. Journalism was not the goal. The goal was to be somewhere involved in the media. And they had a graduate studies program there in human communication studies. And inside of human communication studies, under that umbrella was all forms of communication. Like, it included advertising, it included mass media, which was print, you know, digital at the time, broadcast, all of that was included in it, but also verbal, nonverbal communications, you know, language and cultural communications that we go through as individuals. So all forms of human communication were under the umbrella of that program at grad school at Howard University. So it wasn't journalism at all. I think I've taken one journalism class in my life, ever. But
me too.
I love, you know, like I said, I wanted to have a magazine, so I loved writing. I didn't necessarily want to be a writer, but I loved writing. And what wound up happening is that my letter of interest to get into Howard University was to them so good that they let me in without taking the entrance exam, the GRE.
Wow.
I didn't have to take it. They're like, you're in. And that's kind of when things started to turn. I'm like, okay, what's going on? So while I was at Howard, at grad school, I did what they call a practicum, which is an advanced internship. I did a practicum at BET, and that's where I started to get into television production. So while I was doing my practicum, I was producing shows for Black and for This Week in Black Entertainment, which was a news show, Rap City, and they had a youth show called Teen Summit. And I was working on all three of those shows doing. I was an associate producer. But at the time I was in school, I was also writing commentary for Howard University newspaper. And those pieces I was writing started getting picked up. Washington Post would pick it up and rerun it. You know, USA Today would pick it up and rerun it. The Christian Science Monitor would pick it up and rerun it. The Final Call would pick up something and rerun it. So, you know, and I was like, you know what? And I started getting checks. Now, Sarah, you know the deal. You're in school, and you understand, I'm paying for this, right?
Right.
So when I started getting, the BET thing was a practice. You're not getting paid for that. You're getting experience. But the writing I was doing, at the same time I was working on my thesis, the writing I was doing, I started to get checks in the mail because they were rerunning some of the stuff I was writing. So I'm like, well, hell, what's going on here? And, you know, once again, you sit back and think, all right, where am I going to have impact? You know, is this what I'm here for? Because people seem to be resonating with things I'm saying through writing. And I'm starting to get checks for this, too. So let me start really venturing off into seeing if this is the direction I'm supposed to go in. And once, you know, to be honest with you, once I was able to do what I was able to do with my master's thesis, that's when I was like, okay, I can probably do this. Because at the time I was tackling a subject that had never been tackled before. I was one of the first people in the country to ever do an academic study on hip hop. And, you know, once you get to going through something at that level and accomplishing it, I was like, okay, this writing thing, I think I can do. You know, and that's when I went, like, you know, once I graduated, once I got my master's degree, I'm like, this is it. I'm all in. And that's when it all kind of started to make sense.
What was the dream then? What was the top place that you could work, write, produce, wherever?
Didn't have one. And once again, if I'm speaking to kids, I don't, you know, I tell them the same thing. You know, I've never really had a big dream of working for anyone. You know, my whole focus has always been on the grind. Do what I can control. I have no control over where I'm going to land or who's going to give me an opportunity. You know, so that wasn't it. You know, I would like to have been employed, you know, like to have done some things, but I wound up doing a lot of freelancing because even with the master's degree, even with making the Nationals Dean's List, you know, even with job experience, the one thing they say about when you come out, either education or employment is going to hurt you trying to get into the workforce. I actually had both, you know, and it still didn't help me. I sat with a stack of letters in my bedroom at the time from every company, from MTV to the Reader here in Chicago, that wouldn't give me an opportunity, you know. And what I wound up doing, started freelancing. I started teaching classes at city colleges. And while I wasn't doing that, I was freelance writing. I was writing for various newspapers and magazines about hip-hop because at the time I was one of the few people that academically had looked at hip-hop and had a document that had a study attached to it that could look at hip-hop in a different way. So it wasn't just like album reviews or doing profiles on artists. It was a little bit deeper than that. So I was writing in the Source magazine. I was writing in Rap Pages magazine. You know, I was doing that thing. And then it just got to a point that I just said, F it. And I got tired of writing for people, freelance, and the checks not coming in, or writing stuff. And, you know, what you wrote wasn't, what was published wasn't what you turned in. You know, and I'm like, I can do this for myself, because it wasn't about necessarily trying to find a wide audience. It was about trying to just contribute to the craft of writing. So I started my own magazine.
So,
you know, and
before you move on to your own magazine, a big part of it was that you felt like somewhere in the editorial process, what you had submitted changed before it ran, and you didn't believe in what the edited version was.
Yeah, I mean that too, because it takes your voice away, you know, and trying to say what you want to say or what you feel needs to be said in that moment at that time on that subject matter. But also, it's not just that. But keep in mind, like I said, it was also not getting paid.
Yeah,
you know, let's be honest. I mean, you do stuff, and then you know, folks don't pay you, at some point you're going to stop. You're like, yo, this has to stop. Why am I doing this? And I can do this for myself. And that's what I wound up doing. So I go back to what I said in high school, me and my best friend Brad. We said we wanted a magazine. That's what we did. Brad was a graphic artist here in the city of Chicago. I was in Chicago doing freelance writing. We took our whatever little talents we did, and we started a magazine. And there it is. So to answer your question, it really wasn't a goal set out to try to work for this and that and work for somebody and do this. It was more of the philosophy of if you aren't where you are in your life, you have to do for yourself or you're going to die a slave. And I refused to die a slave. You know, so I just took matters into my own hand, and that's kind of the way I've always operated in speaking to people and trying to look at goals. Because, Sarah, you notice ESPN, I was just at a conference at the same thing. ESPN happens to be so big that it's everybody's lifetime destination if they want to get into sports journalism.
Right.
They want to come straight out of college. I want to work for ESPN. I'm like, y'all need to stop that. Because ESPN is a great place. It's great. It's dope. It is the top of the food chain. But you're going to miss a lot of steps in the process if that's where your starting point, if that's where you want your starting point to be.
Right.
You know, and not only that, you're giving them too much power over your entire career. You know, if you look at the Michael Wilbons of the world, you know, the other individuals, not really Bob Lee, but Bob Lee, you know, but all the cats that have risen to, you know, some type of prominence inside the ESPN, go check their backstory. They did not start there.
Right. Yeah.
They all went through all type of stuff. You know, John Papanek and Sports Illustrated, you know, everybody started somewhere. That's that process that a lot of these individuals are missing now because there's such a rush to get to the end game.
For sure.
Such a rush. And that's
absolutely
the goal. That's the dream. And I'm like, I don't believe in it. You have no
control. And you might get there when you're not ready. And then
that's the worst thing that can happen. You're right.
All your time there. Even though you can grow and learn and get better there, sometimes you're better served by having experiences in other places and bringing them to ESPN.
Exactly. And they don't understand. And I'm trying to tell them that. And it's like, you can't dream about something that you don't have any control over. And that's always been the way I've operated. I have no control over where I'm going to land, but I do have control over the content that I provide. And that's, to answer your question, what do I dream about? My dream is to be, my dream has always been to, I don't want to sound like, you know, hyperbolic or anything, but to be one of the best writers of this generation. That's my dream. That's something I can control. You know what I'm saying? That's where my whole thing is being. And whatever happens through that, then I'm cool. Whatever the result of that is, I'm cool. But I've never had that dream of, I want to be Gary Smith.
Right.
And work for Sports Illustrated. No, I want to be Gary Smith, period. You know, I want to be as good at what I do as Gary Smith was, and, you know, he retired, but as writing, you know. If I'm at Sports Illustrated or not, that's not the point. I can try to be as good as this dude is. You know what I'm saying? I want to be as good at writing as Stevie Wonder is in music. It'll never happen, but I can't say, I want to write or be at ESPN or I want to have a series on HBO.
Right,
or
it's about the work, not the job. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, it's about what you can control.
So when you were in control, when you had your own magazine, was it what you expected? And did you like the idea of being in control as well as creating content? Because for me, I enjoy not having the sort of entrepreneurial business side because I don't have a background in payroll and stuff like that. You know what
I
mean?
Right, right, right.
I like creating the stuff and not doing the business side as much.
That's a hard thing that a lot of – I had to learn the hard way is that very few people are able to juggle both. You know, because it's like your mind doesn't work that way. Your mind works creatively or it works, you know, strategically. And to find, you know, to be able to do both is a very rare and tough thing to do. To be honest with you, I love the fact of just having something that we were able to put out in the marketplace that was relevant and was important and at that time necessary and needed. So that was more important than anything. It wasn't about just it being me or having control of everything. It's just that, we are contributing in a way that nobody else is. And, you know, even though I didn't go to business school, the one thing I do know, you know, the first thing about not business, but starting a business is understanding where the void is and where you can fill it. And in this particular process, like I said, we knew we wanted to be like the black version of the Village Voice. And that didn't exist. And not that we were going to be that big, but, you know, to provide black visibility, black commentary, you know, that catered to our interests and our needs at the time in a way that wasn't being done, that's what was important. The flip side of that is really working for other individuals. To be honest with you, I've been very blessed and lucky to not have to really, since I started my own, you know, not have to deal with the major pushback on contribution as far as not being able to say what I feel is necessary to be said or what I think is important. I've been very lucky that way.
So when you When did you work for Nike? Was that before or after this?
That is after this. Nike came to me. Nike came to me. What is it? 2000 before I came to ESPN. I was at the time we had done Slam Magazine, we had done Double XL. I was already doing both of the NBA magazines, Nike just they wanted to do a book, and their head of brand design had a concept to do a book for Nike because Jill Knight and Mark Parker, they wanted to find a way to document their 30 years in basketball. And they called me, and his name is Ray Butts, who's head of brand design for Nike at the time. It was his concept. I thought he was calling me for ideas. You know, I get a lot of calls for consulting things, ideas, you know, advice, all this, that, and the other. So that's what I thought he was calling me. I never thought they were calling my black ass to do to write the book, you know. Because, once again, you never think about those things, sir. And that's why I'm not a big believer in specified dreaming.
Right.
Because you can tell me at the time.
You never know where you're going to go.
Right. You know, you don't think of Nike as somebody that's going to find a way into the spectrum of what it is that you're doing as far as writing is concerned. That's not what they do. They're a marketing company and an athletic apparel company. That's what they do. At no point do you ever think, well, I'm going to write a book for Nike. But once again, what did Oprah say? The harder you work, the more luck comes your way.
The luckier you get.
And here I am, ashy-ass black kid from 47th and Ellis. You know, of all the people that Nike could have called, all of them, because they got everybody at their disposal. They reach out to me to document their book, and it's still the only book in the company's history they've ever done. So, You know, and that was in 2000. And I juggled what wound up happening once again. In the process of doing that book, Sarah, that was a one-time deal. Like, all right, here's we're going to bring you on to write a book. Over the course of that, we turned the book over to them. They came back to us and, like, what else do you all want to do? Like, literally, what else do you want to do?
Yeah.
And it happened to me earlier at Slam Magazine. Slam Magazine did so well, the president of the company was like, anything you all want to do, I will finance. We're like, whoa, how often do you get a president of a company to tell you that?
Right, right.
It happened at Slam. That's how we started XXL. We started Honey. We just started, you know, we started baseball magazines, hockey, anything they wanted to be like, look, you all made us so much money. And, you know, you all have found a niche, whatever you all want to do. And we were just coming up with ideas, and they were doing them at Harris Publications for us. Same situation happened at Nike. They called us to do one thing, one book, one-time project. The minute that book was over, they said, what else do you want to do? And Ray was, we were like, we could do it. We were just coming up with stuff, and they were just financing.
Yeah.
Ray was like, let's have a summer basketball tournament and take it all over the world, call it Battlegrounds. We're going to get like eight best one-on-one players in the world and have them go at each other for $100,000. Like, we're going to, you know, and Nike's like, all right, how much you need? Ray said, I need like $10 million to do this. Okay, cool, let's go. No problem.
It's amazing, right? It's amazing.
Right, right,
but you
got to
step up when it happens and do it well
right,
or you don't get the offer again.
But that's why you like the challenge, and that's why I say you dream about what you can't control.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, yeah. So when Nike called about doing a book, I'm like, oh, I got to put my – I have to, you know, this is pressure, but we like pressure. You know, your life has been pressure. You know what I'm saying? Let's go. Let's go. Let's do it. You step up to it, and that's what you can control. So that's why I'm not a big believer of specified dreaming in that. You can't dream this stuff up.
Yeah, for sure.
But if you dream about what you can control, and things – why, like I said, the harder you work, the more luck comes your way.
Tell me about being a scriptwriter and a consultant for MTV Rockin' Jock, because I'm just the right age to have this very nostalgic vibe about Dan Cortez and everything that goes with Rockin' Jock. How did that come about?
The guy who was doing MTV Raps, his name is Jack Benson. All right. He was one of the producers. I don't know if he was the original producer of Your MTV Raps, but he was like the lead producer of Your MTV Raps. And you know, of course, he's probably going through the same thing we just got through talking about. MTV having him there, like, hey, what else do you want to do, Jack? You know, whatever you want to do, we'll do. And he kind of came up with, the idea of merging sports and music because there were people, you know, involved in this. So when it came time to do a Rockin' Jock basketball event, he reached out to me because of what I was doing, because of Slam Magazine and the NBA. You know, he knew my work. He's familiar with my work. and he wanted a certain edge to it that, you know, wasn't Sporting News, wasn't Sports Illustrated, wasn't USA Today. He wanted something that catered more to the MTV audience. And, you know, that's kind of what we were doing at Slam Magazine. And with me being senior editor at Slam, he reached out and said, hey, man, got a project. You mind coming in and working on it? I'm like, no, man, this would be great. This is dope. So he wound up doing a script for it. And here's the funny thing about that experience is that New Kids on the Block was supposed to be a team on that. And they backed out. So we're going out to L.A. We're in a panic mode, like, all right, this thing is balanced out. You can't lose five. Who are we going to replace five people? We have to replace five people. They're like, well, this new group happened to send in a video 2 weeks ago. You know, they seem pretty cool. They're called NSYNC. You think we can get them? Literally. So, like, the 2 weeks after NSYNC's first video hit, we had them in, like, nobody knew who they were. Nobody. And we got them in to replace New Kids on the Block in the Rock and Drive Basketball. You know, and I run around telling people, like, I discovered Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, tell me my boy had handles, because I love him so much.
No, he
will be so sick. I mean, I know he's an athlete. He can golf like crazy.
Yeah, no, before he started really getting into golf, he had a nice game. And that's what they would tell. They said, no, they said, Justin can play. They said, Justin can play, so it works, and he loves basketball. So they're like, it's a perfect fit. You know, so, that was kind of different back in the day, but that's how I fell into it, and it was a great gig.
Yeah.
It was a great
gig.
Jack and I tried to do some stuff after that too.
Yes. Okay. So you've been focusing on basketball for some of the magazine work. You do some culture and sort of sports entertainment mashups. You get to ESPN in 2005, and from the beginning, I think, you know, Well, you tell me, what were you hired to do? What was your beat? What was your expectation when ESPN took you on?
That's a great question. Quick backstory. They came at me four times before I said yes. And I only tell you that because every time they came to me, it was for something singular. Like, we'd like you to come over and sit with Skip. You know, when Woody Page was leaving, like, I'm not moving to Connecticut. We want you to come in and, you know, be a writer for the magazine. And I remember they came to Chicago to meet with me when the magazine was first starting. And I, you know, three editors came to my house. It was during the finals with the Bulls and the Utah Jazz, and they came to my house. And it was really funny, Sarah, to be honest. They didn't think, because of the way I write, you know, and it was before all this, you know, doing, you know, documentaries and television, all this and the other. When you were a writer and you could be, you know, anonymous, you know, nobody knew who you were. All they knew was your byline. You know, they thought I was, you know, I don't know if they, you know, I don't know what they thought I was, but they came to my house. They didn't believe I had a house. They're like, oh, so this is yours? Like, yeah, this is mine. Like, yeah, I own this. You know. And then I walked them down to my office, which is in the basement of the house, right? And I have my 2 degrees on the wall. They're like, oh, so you got a master's. And I said, yeah, that means I'm going to be expensive. and they laughed. So I got everybody a beer, cracked the beer. I said, hey, before we start talking, let me ask you a question. I said, if I wanted to write, I thought it was right for Latrell Sprewell to choke his coach.
Right.
Would you all let me do that ESPN magazine? They're like, oh, no, that would never happen. I said, okay, this is over.
Yeah.
Seriously, they said, what do you mean? I said, I don't understand. I already have a magazine, Slam. I have two NBA magazines I'm working on. Why should I leave three places where they allow me to do whatever I want to go to one place that won't? And they basically said, because it's ESPN. I'm like, okay, cool. You know, so they came at me with stuff like that, just singular stuff. And I had so much going on. Like, think about it, Sarah. You know, we had built Slam Magazine from its inception. That's like your baby.
Right.
And I had a president of the company over at Harris Publications that's allowing us to do whatever we come up with. He's allowing us. He's going to bankroll that. We had the NBA magazines, both Inside Stuff and Hoop Magazine, and we helped launch NBA TV. So we had that going on. I was with Nike at the time. Nike was letting us do whatever we want. They were giving us $10 million to do stuff.
Right. You're the person that ESPN shows up and you're like, nah, I'm good. And they're like, but it's ESPN. And you're like, no, look at all of this.
Right, exactly. They didn't understand it.
Yeah.
So years later, after you know, they came with a couple of things. And then finally, it was Dave Cummings, who is now over at in L.A. handling ESPN podcast now. But Dave Cummings, who I helped build Source Sports with when he was over at the Source before he came over to ESPN, he came to me in New York one time and said, I've been trying to get you over here. I'm finally going to get you over here. And he went and talked to all the Johns, the Skippers, the Walshes, the Costners. You know, he went to the John Car Wash.
Yes, the Johns,
and they put
yes.
something on the table that finally I was like, okay, now we're talking. You know, it was like column on the website, column in the magazine, a chance to create, you know, shows, you know, for the network, be involved, you know, making appearances on radio. You know, it was full throttle, you know, with deliverables in each one. Like, you got 15 television appearances, you know, 30 radio appearances. You know, it was really encompassing of everything. And not only was it encompassing, to me, I'm like, thank you, because to me, that finally showed you all have some respect for what I was doing outside of being at ESPN. You know, you have to take that into consideration.
Right, for sure.
Right, and they finally came to the table, I thought, something that was substantive. To
and
least
what
make
was
me
it?
Listen.
What?
And I knew, I'm not stupid. I can't keep turning ESPN down.
Right.
You know, at some point, they're going to say no. Like, you know, we're done with you. You can, you know, trust me, we'll be fine without you. So those two things happened at once. And once that happened, I was like, okay, you know, that would be stupid for me not to. You know, they put something on the table that, you know, you and I are friends, right? Like, if we're friends and we're this deep in our friendship, and you found out that they put this on the table for me, you beat my ass, Sarah. You'd be like, you damn fool. What is what,
yeah.
You know? They put that deal on the table for me, and I would have been stupid not to take it at that time.
So you started out, and from the bat, you were really writing a lot of opinion. You've always, you know, really been into the intersection of sports and race and
right.
Political issues, social issues, everything else. You were just a year into your tenure there when one of your stories, or perhaps several, set off Jason Whitlock, and he was elsewhere,
right.
and. What is that like? I think that there is, it's a tough topic because it's sort of like women in sports media. Anytime when you are an underrepresented
yeah.
group, people have an expectation of unconditional support, which
mm-hmm.
I think women actually give each other way more support. Everyone talks about being catty, and I rarely see that for myself. I see a lot more support than otherwise, but I don't support
right.
every woman in the industry, and I don't think
right.
it's my job to lift up people who I don't think make the right choices or are particularly great as content givers or whatever. But what is that like to have another African-American journalist in a world where there aren't enough of them try to take you down?
Well, it goes twofold in this particular situation. One, the first part that was troubling was that it's not like we didn't know each other. And it's not like he didn't have an opportunity to tell me how he felt personally.
Right.
That was the first part that bothered me. That was troubling to me, is that, hey, man, look, if you felt this way, we were just together at the NBA Finals. We rode the media bus together. You know, we sat and watched World Cup, you know, in the same, you never said anything. So that was troubling to me, but then it also shows what type of individual that we're talking about. You know, and it's not about being a man. It's just being a human being. If you have an issue with something, especially on the personal level, or even
right.
if it's professional, if you're right there and feel that way, say something. Just say something. I was right. It's not like we don't know you're right in my face. So that was the first troubling thing. You know, the second thing that bothered me is in the process of finding out about what he said publicly about me, what he was saying privately about me, what he was trying to do privately to me inside of ESPN, because he was still, you know, with ESPN at the time. He was just, he made his comments, and I think in Kansas City or in the big lead, I forgot. But, and there's supposed to be a policy that we don't attack each other as writers and this, that, and the other, even if it's, but they tended to let him go with this. You know, and I said, look, man, I can take a few shots, but, you know, now this is getting out of control, because it's every time he does an interview, every time he says something, he's attacking me. I have to be able to say something. And through that process, I found out what he was saying about me and trying to bring me down internally. So that was troubling also, because it goes to the whole, you know, crabs in a barrel theory that you hear about as women and we hear about as minorities. you know, when it comes to business, that we're going to be the first ones to take each other down. So that becomes troubling. But at the same time, I understood it. And I told ESPN, when I was, look, Jason had been there for 4.5 years before I came over there. And to your point, when we are underrepresented, you have that only one person theory that exists. So Jason was for, you know, he and Ralph Wiley passed. It was like, you know, we can only have one black columnist at a time here.
Right.
And before I got there, Jason was that dude. He was there 4.5 years before I got there. 6 months into me coming into ESPN, they started this whole national voice thing where they're going to have 4 national voices. And, well, it was already going on, basically, but, you know, it was in the conversation. But they wanted 4 columnists on the front page of ESPN.com to rotate throughout the week, and they were considered their national voices. 6 months in, they wanted to make me their national voice. I said, don't do that. I haven't been here long enough. That's going to piss people off. And I wouldn't talk about just Jason, just anybody. You know, people, I'm new to this. But what I was writing in my voice was so different. It was more about balance than it was seniority. And sometimes it doesn't play itself out that way. So
right.
That is what ticked off Jason. The fact that he had been there, and I don't know what his expectations were, but, you know, when you have this, you know, one person at a time theory stuck in your head, and you're the only black person there, and you're the only female there, when somebody is placed in a space that you felt you were in position for, that you deserve, you strictly take it out on them.
Yep. Not on the decision makers.
He didn't go after
not on anybody else. Yeah.
Right. He didn't go after Bill Simmons, and he didn't go after Gene Wojciechowski, who were the other three at the time.
Right.
You know, he went strictly at me. You know, and you know, that's why I got it. I got that because you grow up seeing that. Not
right.
That you have to like it. You don't have to respect it. You know, you don't have to honor it. But I understood it. So I understood where he was coming from. And part of that, I said, look, I told you all not to do this. I told you because I knew somebody. I'm pretty sure he was the only one to laugh, but there were probably others that were pissed off, upset, you know, and without even going through understanding. But once again, the thing that troubled me was also the stuff that he was saying behind my back. So
right.
I could deal with all of the, you know, some of the public stuff. You know, when he started calling my family parolees, that kind of went over the line. You know, because now you're talking about my wife, my kids, my brother, you know, all this stuff, you know, that all the other public stuff, not liking me publicly and not agreeing with what I said and the things that I write and, you know, what I, you know, happen to stand for. I get that, you know, but when he started crossing the line and making things personal and, you know, calling me, you know, less than N-words, you know what I'm saying? I'm like, yo, you crossing the line and there's nothing I did personally to you. You know, to do that. So that's where the bother comes in. But there's an old saying that I don't know how many cultures share this, so I don't want to just, you know, attach this to our culture, black culture. You know, but there's a saying that God's going to take care of it.
Right.
You know, and you know, I've looked at, you know, I've put it in somebody else's hands. I've always put Jason's situation in somebody else's hand, and I've never really given it really too much thought after the initial having to deal with him publicly and privately trying to, you know, bring me down in the barrel so that he could come up. Other than that, it hasn't affected. I haven't given him the energy, and you know, what does Evelyn say on Basketball Wives? He's a non-blank-blank-blank factor.
So, I mean, that's, you know, if you can find a person like that, that you decide that they're not worth the time to deal with their criticism, that there's, you know, other issues at play there, whether it's jealousy or whatever else, then you sort of put them aside. How do you deal in a larger sense of having to approach tough topics, and particularly it feels like there are often the same way there are with women or religious people or whatever. There are warring factions within the African-American community in terms of how to deal with things and what your take is on things. And how do you handle criticism of your take on tougher topics? Is it something that over time you've gotten a thicker skin? Did it never bother you if people came at you and called you names or said other things about you? It never bothered you?
No, because if it bothers you, that means you're walking into the game thinking you're perfect.
Right.
You know, thinking you're 100. You know, thinking it's all about you, thinking you're right all the time. You know, how are you going to grow and learn if you start from that as your platform? You know, so my thing in this day is to welcome it, because that's what's going to help me grow to a certain degree. You know, and I have the skin, the heart, the mind to, you know, handle this, you know. And there's an old Public Enemy saying, you know, Chuck D, what does he say? Never question what I am because God knows. Never question what I am. God knows, because it's coming from the heart. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I approach it. You know, I know deep in my heart what my intent is and where it's coming from. You know, at no point have I really tried to be malicious. You know, at no point have I ever tried to print something or write something that was, I felt, untrue. And you have to be open enough to know that sometimes you're wrong.
Right.
You know,
for
I'm not sure. Out here. Right.
You learn and you grow, and that changes things.
Yeah, but I'm not out here batting 900. Nobody is. You know, so to use a baseball analogy, yeah, I'm trying. Look, 300 gets you in the Hall of Fame. You know, and to be honest with you, you know, if I can hit 300, I'm good. If I can shoot 50%, I'm good. You know, look, Sarah, there were people that didn't like Nelson Mandela, didn't like Jesus. And guess what? Nelson Mandela nor Jesus were perfect either. So, you know, and I'm not giving you any BS. This is, you asked me how I deal with it. You just keep that in mind all the time. You're good. You are good.
For sure. And if you believe in your opinions and you believe in your writing, the criticism hurts sometimes, but it you know. As long as you're not someone who's throwing out opinions because it will make you known or famous or, you know, I've never been someone who's been able to say even a pointless opinion solely to get a rise out of people. And there are people in our industry that have made so much money off of that, right? They can take people out. They can make absurd statements knowing that it will drive conversation and elevate their status. That's not my style at all. I can't do that.
It's not. But you understand that this is the way the business is being run, because the business is still generated by money. And, you know, being right and doing stuff from the heart, or doing something you believe in, or doing something that you feel is necessary, that's not going to, you know, get Apple or Nike or, you know, General Electric or Ralph Lauren to write you a check.
Right.
You know, moving that needle is what's going to do that. And in some instances, people do that, but that's a part of the game. So I understand it. I happen not to be that person. You happen not to be that person. But the one thing and I don't want to speak for you, the one thing I think both of us hold true is that we know that if we put out our best work, our best content, it's still going to be able to hold water and float.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we're floating, we're not drowning, and we're doing what's necessary. And it provides a counter to the other side of the game that's doing it to move the needle.
For sure.
You know what I'm saying? So, it's like, look, for every Avengers movie or for every Star Wars movie, there has to be a Moonlight.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Because it's not about, like, you know, there has to be a small budget film. There has to be, an Atomic Blonde. You know, there has to be these small movies that still have an impact. There has to be a John Wicker. There has to be a Get Out. There has to be a Girls Talk.
Right.
You know, Get Out and Girls Talk generate $100 million, they're not billion-dollar blockbusters. But there has to be something in this creative space that we call media that has to have room for these smaller ideas that don't move the needle but are necessary. And that's why I think you and I fall in. And that's why I like to fall in. So I'm not worried about, or I'm not affected by, the criticisms or not getting as many hits or, you know, the numbers, this, that, and the other. Let somebody else worry about that. That's fine. My thing is to provide quality work that people still talk about 10, 15 years from now. You know, that's what's going to do it for me. You know, that's what I think is important, you know.
And your work now, you're doing a lot of stuff for the Undefeated, but your main gig, the head of your resume, is senior writer for SportsCenter. Tell me about balancing those two and what your work looks like right now.
Well, it's really, I've gotten into doing, you know, short video content and writing short video content. A couple of years ago, we transitioned from doing digital.com, me being a columnist at .com, to coming over to, you know, help revive and you know, do something different, bring a different voice to SportsCenter. So it's, you know, started writing scripts for Berman. Then they wanted me to start, you know, because the feel of what I was writing didn't necessarily lend itself to the voice that Chris had. And they were like, yo, you know, we need you to come in and start voicing and start writing and, you know, really, really getting involved and telling stories and doing storytelling for SportsCenter. You know, and at the end of the day, sir, to me, that's what it's all about. It's still, as a writer, it's still about, it's all about telling stories. You know, our whole lives, you know, you doing podcasts is still about storytelling. You still doing your columns for W. It's still about storytelling. What I'm doing, what I did at .com, storytelling. What I do every now and then for Undefeated is still Torah storytelling. What I do for SportsCenter, storytelling. You know, so it's a matter of being able to adapt to whatever form of storytelling you're being asked to, you know, to do your thing in. And that's kind of what's happened over the last couple of years with ESPN is that I've been part of a team called SKU. And, you know, I without being told this, I think we've been given the creative freedom to create content for SportsCenter, you know, in a way that not many are. And it's kind of gone in line with what's happened to me throughout my entire career. I've been put in places where I haven't really had too many handcuffs on me. And people have, you know, believed in the content that I'm able to create and fill a void that's not being there, you know, and use that to their advantage and my advantage, too. You know, so, the SportsCenter piece has been fantastic, you know, being there for the last, this is going on 3 years now, you know, and to, like you said, dealing with subject matters that, you know, don't often get told. A couple of weeks ago, they call a scoop. We want you know you got to take on the Mayweather McGregor fight.
Yep, I'm just played that on a radio show yesterday.
Right, and I'm like, the take is everybody's talking about, and they're trying to sell us because this was in the middle of them right at the back end of their promo, you know, their whirlwind promo tour that they were going on, and everybody's talking about what this fight is. I'm like, why don't we talk about what it isn't? And they're like, that's a good idea, and that's kind of what I'm saying this whole conversation. So it's like, it's the mindset of business, you know, find a void and fill it. Now, I'm not sitting here and saying that, you know, I want people to watch the fight, that I think the fight is bogus and this, that, and the other. The whole focus is, while everybody's saying one thing, let's not act like this other thing doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And my job at SportsCenter, you know, on depending on the situation, is to find what's not being said. And creatively finding a way to tell that piece. Because what that does is that makes the entire story comprehensive. Now you're covering all the bases. You got everything covered. You know, and that's part of the thing that I've been doing over the last couple of years is trying to fill the voids that are not being done. Because SportsCenter, we've been in ESPN long enough. Not just SportsCenter. The entire lineup can be, you know, very monolithic in thought and words. And there are angles and places inside of storylines that are missed.
Yeah.
You know, I think my responsibility is to try to find what is being missed there and use SportsCenter as that platform to at least address some of those issues. And in just recently, you're dealing with a polarizing situation between McGregor and Mayweather, which is dealing with all types of things. You're dealing with color lines, you're dealing with money lines, you're dealing with the professional line between difference between MMA and boxing and the popularity between two sports where it's at a crossroads. You know, there's a whole lot of things that make this entire event polarized. So, you know, okay, how can we tell this story different than anybody else is doing on ESPN's entire landscape? Well, who's talking about what is not? Nobody's talking about it. All right, let's go there.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of where it's been.
Yeah, it seems like a very cool space for you, and then to be able to do some of the work that is similar to what you've always been doing for the Undefeated, of course, is great. Profiles and opinion pieces and all that stuff. You were kind of the Undefeated before the Undefeated existed. You were one man Undefeated.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Mark Spears told me that a long time ago. I appreciate that. I've had a few other people tell me that, but that,
yeah.
You know, and I was just with Kevin, the editor in chief. We just spoke at a panel together over the weekend. We knew each other, but that was my actual first time meeting him. And, you know, speaking of, I just think, you know, just as W is important, just as 538 is important, just as Grantland was important, you know, I think it's important to have a digital space like the Undefeated to, you know, cater toward that area of storytelling that is sometimes, like you said earlier, underrepresented.
For sure. All right, speed round. Best event you've ever covered?
Wow, that's a hard best event. I'm trying to give you a quick answer. Best event I ever covered. The NBA All-Star Game. I can't remember the year, but it was the year that Iverson, Stephon Marbury, and Mutombo came back from 22 points down in the fourth quarter.
Okay.
That,
all right.
That was winning. That was amazing because that forced Philly to go on and draft and get Mutombo in a trade, and Philly wound up going to the championship that year. But to sit there, and I was sitting courtside with Carmen Romanelli, who was the head of photography for the NBA, and to really watch an All-Star game get that competitive, like, it was like, that's one of the things I'll never forget. And second to that, I was at the flu game for Michael Jordan.
Oh, nice.
I was there the whole day. So that was number two.
All right. How that leads me to my next question. How are you going to grow up in Chicago your whole life and be a Knicks fan?
Because in fourth grade, I went to New York, and my father, being who he was, took me to the Garden, but also took me to meet Earl Monroe, who was my, like, hero at the time, and Walt Frazier, like, personally, meet them, you know, and hang out with them. And so after, you know, and going to the Garden, seeing them play, and then, you know, looking at Willis Reed, looking at Dave DeBuscher, you know, looking at Dick Barnett, looking at Jerry Lucas, looking at Red Holston walking up and down that sideline. You know, I had been to the Chicago Stadium before and seen Norm Van Leer and, you know, Tom Boyle and Jerry Sloan and all them, Chet Walker, Bob Love, all that. But there's something magical about being in that Garden. There was something magical about being in, you know, with that Knicks squad, that did it for me. That did it. And I've been a ride or die Knicks fan up until last year. Last year, I filed for divorce, straight up.
I was going to say, it might have felt like a good choice at the time, and then when you were in Chicago during the Jordan years, you were like, whoops.
No. That was the beauty of it. Here's the thing. No, seriously, here's the thing. I was still diehard then. Like, I would go to games. Like, I would – well, I wasn't that unprofessional. I would go to games. But I go to, like, Bulls practices in Knicks gear. Like, Michael and Scotty and all them cats would give me the business.
I bet.
But here's the deal. They respected it because I owned it. You know what I'm saying? I owned it. I was straight.
Well, you missed out on enjoying a good run. You missed out.
Oh, yeah, but no. It wasn't like I loved it. I loved the Blues, but I was just a Knicks guy. That was it. Yeah. I was a Knicks guy. I rolled with it. And then when Oakley went over there, it got really bad.
Yeah.
It got really bad when Oakley went over there.
All right, favorite athlete to interview?
It's a tie between Allen Iverson. It's a three-way tie. Allen Iverson, Chris Webber, and Grant Hill. I've always
said
that.
Least favorite athlete to interview?
John Stockton.
Really?
And I say that because I've never interviewed him. He's never granted me an interview, and he's never even spoken to me.
Huh.
And I've heard, you know, I've had Karl Malone, Jeff Hornacek, Byron Russell, all this and other. They're like, that's John just being, that's who John is. I'm like, dude, you've seen me for years. And just the courtesy, you know, hey, John, what's happening? You don't even speak back? I've never written anything bad about him. Never, you know, I don't mean, you know, I don't know. But I answer that question the way it is because I've never interviewed him, so technically I didn't give you a full answer. I've never interviewed him, so.
It works. Okay. What's the
Oh, and you know what? I'm going to give you one more. Michael Vick.
Why is that?
Because I have a problem when athletes lie directly to your face.
Okay.
I just directly to you, and not just me. There's another friend of mine that he, like, lied directly to our faces.
We'll leave it at that.
Yes.
And now you have to do the thing that everybody does before they get to leave.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
The Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects it. Even people who listen to the pod every week. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Gifted with. And now I'm not trying to get, when you say gifted, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean by gifted?
Like you were like, just born to be able, and no, to you be were able amazing
to do
at
it
something.
At, like to be able to do it at a high level?
Yes.
Or to be do it at all? Probably DJing.
Interesting.
I love music, and I would say that's the one thing I would love to do. If I really had the talent, and I could spin a little bit, but I can't spin the way I'd like to be able to spin where it would have been my other choice besides writing.
Yeah.
If I could really, really, really DJ, like really, if I had the skill set, and I'm not talking about New York DJ, I'm talking about like Chicago house party, being able to blend, travel all over, like one of those type dudes. If I had that skill set, if I had a skill set of a Jesse Saunders, an Alan King, you know, a Terry Hunter, all the way down to a DJ Kid Capri or a Jazzy Jeff or a DJ Premier, P Rock, if I had those skills or a Cascade skill or, you know, those type of skills, I'd be good. But I don't have that skill set. I could spin a little bit, but not at that level. I wish God had blessed me with that.
Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
It's not the greatest album ever, which I still believe is probably That's the Way of the World by Earth, Wind, and Fire. But if I had to only have one with me to take with me, probably Songs. Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has to. You can't, you know, it's hard to live without James Brown in your life. It's hard to live without, you know, some hip-hop in your life. But, you know, it's hard to live without Michael Jackson, you know, even you know, maybe Earth, Wind, and Fire, the Beatles in your life. But, you know, if you're on an island, you got one, it may be Songs for me. It may be Songs. Yeah, I'm pretty set on that. I'm Songs. It's Songs. That's a great question.
Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Dead or alive.
Doesn't matter.
Nelson Mandela.
Ooh, good one. It's an interesting one. Yeah. What part of his life would it be?
Damn. That is impossible. Because I respected him so much for what he did with the ANC when he was young and being the leader of that resistance that was so necessary. I'm a believer that sometimes in life, when your life is on the line and your survival is on the line, it's not a time necessarily to be passive. So you need to at least show that you can fight and you're willing to fight and that you're willing to die. So I respect and honor that so much. And, you know, I like to think I have some of that in me. But the compassion of what it took for him to get beyond that and become who he became and actually liberate people by taking that route and being able to be alive to see that take place. I have to say probably the second part. As much as I respect and honor the first part, you know, the pre-Robben Island and inside of Robben Island, I think if you had to spend a day in his life, I would like to have been there when he saw you know, not just him becoming the first black president of South Africa, but feeling that what it felt like to feel that he was partially responsible for liberating his people.
Yeah.
That day, and him knowing what he did, he was never a selfish person, you know what I'm saying? But you know in your heart that you did good work.
Yeah.
You know, I would like to have been in for that one day to see what that felt like. That's a feeling not too many people have in their lives.
Agreed.
So that's the one person in the one day. I take that.
Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Snap. I don't fear easy. That's a good one. Wow. That's a really good one. That's a good one. You know what? Now that I think about it. I never even thought about this. Probably when my wife went into labor with our first son 5 weeks early.
Mm.
And I remember thinking, and it was a quick fear, but I kept thinking about how many miscarriages my mother had.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I hope, you know what I'm saying? I'm hoping this isn't a continue, you know, I'm hoping this doesn't play itself out this way.
Yeah, that's it.
But I remember, I don't know if it's fear, it's just maybe the most fearful thought. Because that was a fearful thought, but, you know, when she went into labor, you can't think of all that stuff, you know, and you don't want any negative. So it goes in and out. But I could be honest, I think that may have been, because that was like, you know, that was that gut-wrenching, you know, you ever had that feeling where your stomach goes hollow?
Mm-hmm, for sure.
That was, yeah, I had that feeling then, and I think that may have been just the most fearful thought I've ever had, so I guess that's the most fearful, you know.
What would you consider?
I guess that would be the answer. I've never thought about that, but I think that was it.
Next one, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Biggest failure. Wow, that's a great one. That is a really good one. I think my biggest failure is probably where I am right now. And that's not being greater than I am in a bigger space than I am. It's funny because I look at somebody like a Vance Jones. I mean, a Van Jones on CNN.
Right.
You know, I look at what he's been able to do to move people. You know, to be at the center of what is really, really important in black lives, you know, and how he's able to galvanize and be the voice of us. You know, I look at Don Lemon on CNN and look at how he's holding it down. I look at the sisters that started the Black Lives Matters movement. You know, I look at what Ava DuVernay has been able to do with film. You know, doing not just, you know, Selma, but also doing the documentary 13th. You know, I look at what, you know, someone like Spike Lee's been able to do in film. You know, I look at the, you know, and what he's been able to do as far as, you know, even right now, like being at the center staging, you know, a boycott, you know, at the NFL headquarters because of the treatment that of Colin Kaepernick. You know, I look at those individuals and always think that is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I marvel at those individuals because they're doing things that I would like to do on a bigger stage, but I'm here doing this. And I'm not saying what I'm doing is not important, but, you know, once again, coming up the way I've come up, I've always felt that my failure is not doing what they are doing because I'm supposed to be doing it on a much bigger platform, much more consistency, and having much more impact on our culture. And I'm not. So, I'm actually,
are you working towards that, though?
Living.
Do you want that? Do you want something outside of sports, or do you want to try to be within sports but just have a bigger impact?
No, not at all, because I've always looked at the history and the prism of sports and how it's applied itself to us in America, black people in America, And without sports, we don't even become beyond the 3/5 of human being that the law had us at. You know, people forget it was Dr. King that thanked Jackie Robinson and Don Newcomb for giving him the strength to do what he did.
So it's, you know, not about breaking, the place,
Larry
it's
Doby,
about
Larry Doby
the
and them breaking the color line in 1947. Is, you know, you talk to Dr. King, his doctor, he told them thank you. You know, you look at the role Muhammad Ali has played in making understand black pride and being proud of who you are and not being ashamed and put down. You know, you look at what Jackie Robinson did. You look what Arthur Ashe meant. You know, you look at what Jack Johnson did. You look at all the things that have happened. You know, Jackie Robinson didn't break the color line in sports. You know what I'm saying? There's so much connected to sports that have association with our, you know, emancipation as human beings in this country. So, no, I understand sports is essential, not only to our history, but our continual existence in this country. So I'm blessed to have that role inside of sports. But that's where it is right now, which is fine. But my failure in my own sense of destiny was to be involved in sports, but greater than sports at the same time, to transcend sports in a much larger way.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and I haven't done that, but it's not from lack of trying, you know. And like I said, I have no control over that, but I marvel at those individuals that have been able to take what they do, take their craft, and have it speak larger. Like Van Jones speaks larger than politics. You know, Don Lemon has been able to speak larger than news, not only just on news items with him being an anchor and holding down in spite of CNN and dealing with individuals the way he deals with them, but also for the gay rights movement.
For sure.
He's bigger than that. You know what I'm saying? Ava DuVernay is bigger than a filmmaker. Spike Lee is bigger than a filmmaker. You know, so I look at individuals like that. You know, and like, they're holding a bigger space and transcending what it is that they're doing. And, my biggest failure is that I'm not a part of that.
Well, you got time. You know, you got time.
Oh, yeah. No. It's, you know, it's still there. It's still, look, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
That's right. Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Being unapologetic.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one thing. Yeah. I think it's not for just the sake of being unapologetic, but also really going through full throttle thought process before I speak or create or write. You know, I've always challenged myself to what I believe is the fullest that I possibly can. You know, and you know, not freestyle, not shoot from the hip, not be flippant. You know, go through this process so that if I am wrong, I'm not wrong due to just ignorance. You know, like I went through all of this process. So that has allowed me to operate in a space of, I'll make up a word, unapologeticness.
Yes.
And what I've been able to do and what I've been able to write. So I think that I don't know if it's a great question. It's a quality I try to hold true to.
Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Everything.
Be more specific.
You always, like you say, you got a long time, so you're always trying to work on something. I wish a lot of times I was more open-minded. I wish at times I thought about the opposite side of impact of things that I feel strongly about. I wish I didn't talk so much. I wish I didn't talk so fast. I wish I didn't talk so loud. I wish I would listen to, I wish I would listen more. you know, because that allows you to read more. I mean, to learn more. I wish I would read more. I wish I, you know, take the time to read more. I wish I wasn't so critical of myself. You know, I could go down the line. You know, I wish I wouldn't find fault with so many things. You know, I can go down the line. I can go down the line. I could tell you. I can hear this. I wish I was more like the back end of Nelson Mandela than I am to the front end of Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Because I try to be a nice guy. You know, but it doesn't play itself out that way all of the time because, like a lot of other people, I get in my own way. You know, and that's the one thing I think as we get older and we grow, we try to not get in our own way. We try not to block our own blessings. And that, you know, that happens often. I know it happens often in my life. And, you know, I wish I didn't do that so often. I wish I was more like, you know, the more civil, the more understanding, the more peaceful, you know, the more let's do this with love as opposed to strategy and anger and emotion, you know. For sure. And I haven't gotten to that space yet. And maybe it's because of the situations we're living in that I look at the world as that if that's equivalent to letting your guard down, and we're not in a position to let our guard down. You know, and when we, you know, the minute we do let our guard down, you know, University of Virginia happens, and we're back at it again.
Yeah, that's true, and that's that balance that you're looking for, right, is when you need to be the back end and when you need to be the front end. And
Exactly.
Finally, number 8, what 3 words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
He smelled good.
After all those deep and thoughtful questions.
When I'm dead and gone, I want that on my tombstone. Is that he smelled good. I take pride in smelling good.
Well, that's where we'll finish it. Thanks so much for your time, Scoop.
Anytime, sir. Thanks for having me on.
Well, that's what she said.
Oh. And another thing.
This edition of That's What She Read comes from the LA Times. It's a Q&A with Stephen Colbert. You can search for it either by perhaps the author of the article, Glenn Whip. Glenn with 2 N's, Whip with 2 P's. Cool Whip. Search Glenn Whip and Stephen Colbert. Or you could search the headline, which is Stephen Colbert on ideas that could kill us all and the moment that changed his life. I just think Stephen Colbert is a fascinating person, incredibly smart, thoughtful, funny, educated. He has the memory of, I don't understand how he is able to remember quotes and Bible verses and people and memories going back so far. I just think he's brilliant and fascinating. And I love this Q&A with him. I will read you just a small part of it. Says the interviewer, wasn't that a turning point in your life, meeting a Gideon on the street when you were a young man? Colbert says, yes, I picked up a box of little pocket Gideons, New Testament Proverbs and Psalms from a Gideon on the street in Chicago. It was one of those 20 below days, and it was so cold I had to snap the New Testament over to my knee to get the pages to turn. And I immediately opened it to Matthew 5, and it was the Sermon on the Mount. Quote, do not worry, for whom among you by worrying can change a hair on his head or add a cubit to the span of his life? Really, that moment changed my life. I understood what it spoke to me meant, because it didn't feel like I was reading it. It just felt like it was literally just talking. Interviewer, you must feel a debt of gratitude toward that guy from that cold Chicago morning. Colbert, that impulse toward gratitude is what originally relinked me to the idea of God. Interviewer, what are you grateful for these days? Colbert, well, it's always the same thing, which is to exist. That's the baseline. There's a great line from this Neutral Milk Hotel song. I think it's In the Aeroplane Over the Sea. It goes, and when we meet on a cloud, I'll be laughing out loud. I'll be laughing with everyone I see. Can't believe how strange it is to be anything at all. So why is there something instead of nothing? Why am I here instead of nowhere? That's the first thing I have to be aware of. And then I'm grateful for my children and my wife. That's first. And then, as the hymn goes, for the beauty of the earth comes after that. It's a great interview. I'm not a particularly religious person, but I think Colbert's ability to pull out of spirituality and out of biblical literature moments that can apply to all things in life is fascinating and interesting and compelling. And particularly having gone through what he has as a person in terms of grief and the deaths of so many of his loved ones, that Sermon on the Mount, and understanding that the worry that you might have won't change a hair on your head or add a cubit of span to your life is something that he lives by for very good reason. Anyway, it's a great interview with the LA Times. You can find it. And thanks, as always, for lasting over an hour with me.
That's what she said.